I think we have zero right to throw stones at the evil dictators of old. You say of like, look at the droves of people they murdered. And we're murdering 1 million babies a year. What right do we have to castigate the dictators of old as evil? We're doing the same thing.
So you have got an amazing YouTube channel, ministry, story, everything. We're gonna get into it. But what I love about your stuff is that you're always challenging men to get more involved in fighting for life, standing up for families, marriage, children. So thank you for doing that, because we need more male voices.
Well, thanks. It really has just been the outward growth of my own journey. I just talk about what I think is important, what's noble, what's true. And I'm on this journey. And years ago, I turned on a camera and invited some other dudes to be like, hey, left and right, let's advance forward together. And so the movement spread, and there turned out to be quite a few other guys that were built like me.
Okay, so what does that mean? Warrior Poet Society, I think it's the name of the channel.
Yeah.
What does it mean to be a warrior poet?
So it's somebody who lives for higher purpose. And that could be pretty wide ranging. It's not just my direct beliefs, but you can sign on with, I live for higher purpose, and I'm ready to sacrifice in the defense of that end. I care about people, I care about truth, and I say I'm a defender of both. And so warrior poet, it's also has the ancient feel of a freedom fighter. It's somebody who buys in archetypically to the role of a warrior, but also that of a poet, which I believe to be a man, you really need to be both. To be one or the other is going to lead to grave deficiencies in your buildup. You will be a failure as a man, ultimately, throughout your life, if you're not embodying both of those aspects simultaneously.
So basically, not machismo, because that's the just warrior on steroids. I'm just going to be this, like, tough guy. And it's not the sort of, I'm just going to be a beta male.
Yeah.
It's this combination of what? I mean, what does that mean more when you say both poet and warrior?
So if I unpack the archetypes, I'm drawing on different strengths and going after different pieces. The warrior is pretty obvious to a lot of guys. I'm like, all right, I'm a protector. I'm dangerous, which means I can defend against somebody who wishes to harm the innocents. I am long suffering. I have grit. I can manage pain. I can manage fear. And so all those aspects of a warrior comes through. Some of these hardcore loyalty aspects, self-sacrifice aspects, physical pain and exertion, toughness, strength. That's warrior stuff. And guys, that's just built in, or it should be. I think every guy has that to some degree. Sometimes it's more repressed, but you can find some dude who doesn't really exhibit any of those qualities, and he is going to lean forward as he watches Mel Gibson's Braveheart movie and just be ready to paint his face blue and charge, you know, the fields of Falkirk, you know? And so every dude
as he holds his pizza and his beer. But he wants to. And then I think that's the thing. You're wanting to empower men to actually be able to do that.
Cheeto dust on his belly and all. He's ready to assault the
plane. But that's part of what you're doing is, like, men should work, you know, and women too, because I know your wife is, like, very tough too, but it's like work out, you know, be prepared to defend, have strong integrity, these different values.
But my wife is tough, but she's not tough in the same way as I am. We have different roles. She's built different. She is gloriously all female. I didn't want her to have my masculine attributes. I want feminine attributes. It turns out I'm actually very attracted to female attributes. And so she's, ta-da, amazing. I didn't want her to be just like me. Now there's the poet archetype, and this is tapping into awe-inspiring beauty, you know, of like, I'm enthralled by my wife's beauty. I'm attracted to that. This is everything from, a woman, a muse, but it's also, you know, standing at the edge of a waterfall and being swept away with it. Men should be deep waters. Ever so much as being a warrior and protector, being a romantic. That is absolutely just as much a masculine attribute. albeit it's not praised by a lot of the door kickers that I roll with in special operations before. No, romantic is a necessary attribute. Yeah, a warrior can defend his family, but after defending, I mean, such a brute to live with, you'll end up imploding your relationships and losing all that you cared about before. If you don't know how to, you know, get on the ground and play with your kids, I want to be an emotionally available father. I want to be a lover of my wife. You know, I want to dance our years together through the kitchen and always flirt. I'm never going to let that fire of our relationship burn out. And so those are attributes of the poet. They're the ones, poets are the ones who will lean in and answer the harder philosophical and the harder theological questions. You know, it's not enough to grab a rucksack and climb up a mountain. I'd like a destination, a journey. And it's your philosophy and theology of life that the poet plots so that the warrior may tread it. And so both attributes are absolutely critical. Most of life, for us in the United States at least, isn't keeping the marauders from coming and burning our village camp, you know, of like there's no ninjas in the bushes.
That's a video game, right?
I wouldn't know. Barely ever play video games.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. I'm a grown man with an incredible amount of responsibilities, and when I'm not serving those responsibilities, I'm hanging out with, you know.
Are you anti-video game?
I'm not anti-video game. I'm not anti, but I am... I'm very pro-life balance, and I'm very pro-stewardship.
Okay.
So my sons, my 10 and 11-year-old sons, when it rains outside, all farm chores are done, all homeschool is done, and they've been good. If it's raining outside, now we'll play James Bond GoldenEye on the Wii, and we get all into it. Or they'll play Mario Kart or some older video game system. The new stuff of like there's these interactive video games that are so amazing. If I gave myself over to them, I'd get sucked in. I would never be able to get it. That looks fantastic. You know, you'll lose me until I find the skeleton sword and rescue the universe from intergalactic destruction. And then what ambition from real life has been robbed through that virtual system? And so I guess I want to have some video games and use them without video games having and using me up. And so I want to show my boys moderation and enjoyment of something without giving yourself over without restraint. Because a young man is rarely able to moderate how fantastic these games are. And so if you can balance and do it a little bit, have fun to the glory of God. But if you can't, that you will pay for your video games in the massive amount of hours that you spend doing it in a robbed ambition and influence later in life. You're giving up more than you know in your love and unbridled use of video games. So I say use video games, but I give a fatherly loving caution.
That's good. That's actually a really good analysis.
Thank you.
Because I've heard a lot of people praise like the intricacies of the modern games, but then they're so addictive because they're more stimulating, like you're saying, than they feel can feel more stimulating than the real life experience.
That's right.
And that's a tragedy.
It robs our young men of ambition. They just accomplished something incredible, something amazing. And when they're done, they have, even though it was pixels on a screen, they still borrow those feelings of victory and accomplishment. And now they can rest from their incredible labors instead of going out and actually doing something real with their life. You know, like, it helps me with my reflexes and hand-eye coordination. You could have been boxing. You could have learned how to fight. That helps with coordination and reflexes and hand-eye. You could actually learn a real skill that could be useful in defending someone. You could get physically fit. That would help you in a whole bunch of different ways as well. And so it's the ambition-sapping nature of video games. It's not that they're inherently bad. It's the opportunity cost of indulging heavily in them. A funny story, real quick. My wife and I were living abroad in Central America, and we had gotten a Wii, you know, the little nunchuck. Did you ever play, like, the tennis game or anything like that?
No.
They were fun.
Okay. I believe you. Maybe one time I did the thing where you're like stepping on something at a friend's house.
Yeah.
Is that what that is? No, it's a little different.
I think so. It depends how long we're...
Obviously, I'm not very into video games. So.
You know what? I think we'll all forgive you for it. You have not missed a lot. But I was playing Lego Lord of the Rings.
Okay, that sounds kind of interesting.
It was cool.
Legos are cool. I know my son, my four-year-old son, we play together, and yeah. Lord of the Rings was awesome, so.
I was really into this video game, and I played it for a while, and then I played it longer and longer until just entranced in this video game. I heard my wife from the corner of the room, "What are you doing?" And I just kind of became aware. I came out of the video game system, and I was aware that though it was night when I started, the sun had come up.
Wow.
I played.
She'd gone to bed.
And woke up.
And woke up, and you were still
playing. I played the whole night.
And didn't know it.
I was in it. I was stuck in this stupid game.
Were you eating Cheetos?
I looked down and I'd gained 250 pounds and
the worst. Now
so it's the worst. But anyway, I realized, man, I'm like, man, I got sucked in, and that's a danger. And I got rid of the gaming system.
So the warrior poet, the poet helps guide the warrior to direct his energies.
That's right.
Towards greater purpose. Okay, so I love that concept. I was talking to my husband before coming here, and one of the things that he was in the Navy, and I know you have a military background, I want to hear about that, but he was called a warrior poet by some of his friends, and I can see, you know, obviously being married to him, I love all these things about him, but he has both of those attributes. Mm-hmm. And I think in our society today, it's hard to hold them both together because on the one hand, men are asked to be really sensitive, almost to become more like women. And people feel that some people are concerned we're rejecting masculinity. And then there's a concern about machismo, that men are being too, they're not sensitive enough, or they're not, they don't direct their strength enough, and they become problematic in that way.
Yeah.
So the solution, it sounds like, is the warrior poet.
Yeah, it's a false analogy. And so you're never going to find your way out of that trap. Mm-hmm. Well, which one is, it's both. It's both and. Mm. You should never be a lover or a fighter. You should be both. Mm. I'm a lover and a fighter. I'm a lion and I'm a lamb. Both, just like Jesus was in Revelation 5. He is the lion of the tribe of Judah, and he's the lamb that was slain to forgive the sins of the world. He is simultaneously both forever. And so we as well are called to be lions and lambs, warriors, and poets.
What was it in your background that made you come to decide, okay, I'm going to launch this whole program to teach men the warrior poet way, and then you write a book, The Warrior Poet Way. What was John like at 20 years old, and what was he doing?
John at 18 or 19 was a punk.
Okay.
You wouldn't have liked me. I don't think I liked me. But I had an encounter, I would say, a salvation experience where I was a completely different kind of guy. And then I got saved through belief in Jesus. And so that happened around 19 years old. And so,
what were you doing before that?
I was in college.
But like, how were you raised? Did you have any faith? Were you
in and around the church? You know, we're Presbyterians and we're Baptists and Episcopalians and non-denominational. And we kind of jumped around, and I was all of it and I was none of it. And I left the house at 15 and got shipped off to boarding school. I was a bad kid. I was a problem kid. And I think my parents wanted me to have a faith. And for a little while in my childhood, you know, you kind of placate the parents and you play the game. But at 15, you know, especially when I went out, and even years before then, I was into all kinds of bad stuff. My parents didn't even know how bad I had really descended. The boarding school, I continued to be the exact same, but I dropped all the pretense of Christianity or anything like that. And so wasn't looking for God. I was having fun. I was doing my own thing. I was big into wrestling. But I was not on the path, and I wasn't looking for it, and I didn't care where I was at.
And so you went from that to when you changed your life.
So I just joined the military. I wanted to go be a special operations guy, you know, like the that Army commercial everyone saw of like, ooh, I want to ascend out of a puddle with an M4, you know, and scan around, camouflage. I want to do all that. By the way, no one's ever done that. No, no one's doing that. They just did that for a commercial.
I did a lot of paperwork. That,
no, it wasn't paperwork. Okay. But anyway, I had those aspirations. I want to do that. When I was about to enter into basic training, I was like this in-processing piece for the military. It's very, very easy. But for me, it was difficult. I had this encounter, this Jesus moment that I wasn't looking for and I didn't expect to come. And through a couple day agonizing kind of process, the Lord in a supernatural way that I really just, I've tried many times to describe it, but if you haven't gone through it, I don't know what to say of like, my heart was being shattered and remade. I'm like, well, what does that look like? I'm like, I don't know. Nothing like that's ever happened to me before. I don't have words to explain it. Describe being in love with your spouse. You could have a few, but no amount of language would be able to really do justice to what that, I love this. I'm going to spend the rest of my life with them. Of like, you want to swear to the moon and the stars, you know, you want to laugh and cry all at the same time. How do you describe that? That was my salvation moment. It was the best moment of my life. It was also the worst. It was awful and terrible. And that's what it felt like to meet Jesus for the first time.
What instigated that? What was there somebody you talked to? Was there a rock bottom you had?
Nope, I wasn't rock bottom. I was kind of having a good time. There was one dude in basic training I'd met, or right before. So his name was Kevin Reinhardt, and he was a Christian, one of the real ones, one of the good ones.
What does that mean?
He's a guy you know is a Christian, even though he doesn't have to tell you. Mm-hmm. You just are around him and you sense this is something different. This is something authentic. This is something real. He's got something I don't. Mm-hmm. He's better than me. And I didn't like him for it. And I was very attracted to him mm-hmm. because of it in a kind of like, what do you have? Why are you different? I cannot explain this. And so he was there, but he didn't like, he wasn't like evangelizing me. He was just kind of around me, and we befriended each other, but that was it. No, I wasn't searching, and I didn't find the Lord in this, that I pursued him. Mm. Zero. No, that did not happen to me. It was more like Paul on the road to Damascus.
Wow.
Paul was not looking for Jesus, and he got crushed.
Wow.
I got crushed. I got ambushed. I got assaulted.
How? But can you, was there something specific you can share? No, it was kind of the supernatural spiritual experience.
I heard the Lord in my head, you've done your own thing long enough, now you'll work for me. It's
wow.
One of the very few times in my life where I actually felt like I heard words.
Wow.
And it was in my head. It wasn't an audible thing. It was just in my head. And even in the retelling, I feel vulnerable because it's not clean and pretty.
Yeah.
It's not as intelligible and logical and explicable as I would prefer to. I'm a logical, analytical guy. I'm not prone to fits of emotion. I can, mm-hmm. I have self-autonomy over my emotions. And even at that time, to some degree, I did as well. But looking back, no, it was I feel, looking back, I had as much to do with my own spiritual birth as I did with my actual natural birth.
Wow.
The Lord is the author and perfecter of our faith. And I wasn't looking for him. He was looking for me. He initiated my salvation. I didn't. I didn't seek him. He sought me and he found me and he changed me. Mm. I did nothing to contribute to my salvation except the sin that made it necessary.
Do you know the poem, The Hound of Heaven?
Yes. Yeah, I do.
Makes me think of that poem.
Yeah.
What you're describing.
People have different salvation experiences, and all I can do is recount what happened to me. Mm-hmm. And so.
All right. So then you go on, you're transformed and transforming into who God wants you to be, and you get married. Mm-hmm. I've met your lovely wife, and you begin a family. Tell me about the trajectory of getting to the place where you're starting Warrior Poet, you're writing the book, and you're starting Warrior Poet Society. And then I want to hear about how you got into pro-life leadership, because that's yet another step.
Sure. So a good bit of stuff happens along the way. We became full-time missionaries for years. I started a business before that, and so I was in the business world. My wife and I both graduated from college. We met in college. Let's see. I was a trainer working for teaching tactical teams, whether it's federal agencies, SWAT teams, military guys. I was teaching small unit tactics in the way of night vision and low light operations to these tactical teams and gun training. So I was doing this after the mission field. And so I was doing this full time, going back into my old days in Ranger Battalion and reviving some of that expertise from the past. And so I had all this kind of going along. Warrior Poet Society was more of it was my own personal journey. I started making video content, and I didn't like kind of the machismo, as you would put it, that I saw. It was this hyper-masculine bravado that was bereft of the authenticity, the other parts of masculinity. Now I have the tidied up language of warrior poet to be able to tell you what I'm talking about. But I saw all warrior, or I saw all poet culturally. And with a military guy, there was something, there was a lie in this 1,000-yard stare, you know, kind of mechanical, even-keeled super soldier. And that was a provocative thing of like merciless feeling. And that was kind of
I don't
like,
cry like that.
I don't mm-hmm. cry.
You cry.
yeah. Absolutely. Now, if I was, if I stump my toe, I'm not crying. You know, if my sons do as well, I'm like, hey, suck it up, bud. Mm-hmm. No, this is not what men cry over. Mm-hmm. So physical pain, dudes, don't cry. Suck it up. But no, of like, I recognize reading the Bible, the greatest man that ever lived and still lives, Jesus, when informed about the depth of his friend, he wept. And people said, look how he loved him. Mm. And so I think the measure of a man is at least in part by how great this man loves. Mm. And if you never cry, you never weeping for any of those around you in their loss, in their tragedy, in your joy, in your love, how weak of a man are you? Mm. You don't love deeply, do you? That's why you don't cry. You don't love deeply. Mm. And so I think there are tears that are weak, and that's you broke your arm and you cried about it. Bro.
Even an arm break, that's gonna be really painful.
Yes, and y'all get to cry.
I've never broken my arm, but.
Y'all get to
cry.
Is there
any physical pain you're allowed to cry over as a man, in your opinion?
Ideally, no. Never cry. Now, I don't think I could pull that off.
Wow.
But Jesus was scourged, hung, and yet he did not cry out. And I'm like,
Father, save me, let this cup pass.
I'm saying,
he sweated blood. That's right. You did. It just
so you're allowed to cry blood.
You can cry blood. All right. Tears. Wow.
No, I'm like, I think men are meant to be extremely tough, extremely strong. Hmm. If you do cry under pain, hey, don't let that affect you. Absorb it, take it. Now, I don't know if I'm being tortured by Al-Qaeda and they're pulling my fingernails off and shattering my teeth and doing whatever. I'm probably going to weep because I'm not as strong as I need to be. But ideally, no, I don't think men should cry over physical pain. Mm. I just don't. Maybe I'm wrong, but no, you know what? I don't care. No, I don't think dudes should cry over physical pain. And I'm on the path. I'd like to be tougher so that nothing's going to move me to do that.
But cry over the beauty of God's creation, or cry over a friend who's suffering.
I'll fall to pieces.
Interesting.
Like me and my wife, when the movie Les Miserables came out, this is the one with Hugh Jackman and Russell Crowe. Oh, I ugly cried, Lila. Ugly cried. We went and saw it 3 weeks in a row when it came out in theater.
That's so funny.
It's my second favorite movie. And moved to tears, and unashamedly, I don't care. Those are strong tears. I know what motivates them. And so I don't even know. I'll just let them go. I'm like, yeah, rock on. I don't care. I'm shameless.
But if someone tries to cut your arm off.
Nope, don't cry.
No crying.
No crying. You're a dude. This is part of the thing.
So we're going on different places here, which I love. But like, so for women, childbirth, obviously, there's screaming. There can be crying. There can be, I mean, it is intense. So you're saying like men, you know, part of a man because they're designed to protect is to have that high threshold for pain and practice that. What about women?
Don't make too much of my diatribe.
Okay.
men not crying of physical pain. I'm saying it fairly tongue in cheek.
Okay.
But the general point I'm underscoring is valid and true.
Okay.
Women can have an incredible high pain threshold. I watched my wife deliver two kids and
It's pretty intense.
And so, no, but y'all are built a little different. And no, you're still tough and you're still strong. And holy cow, that's amazing. But I don't know. Y'all get a pass. Y'all can cry over whatever you want, and you will. And that's all right.
Well, it's also hormonally a reality, right? Because women our hormones are just different. Obviously, biologically, we're different from men. And so, you know, there's a reason, like, you know, even just, you know, we were talking about pregnancy, but women, like, on a monthly basis, they have this dramatic, you know, 28-day cycle. And that includes, like, a very, you know, clear adjustments in their emotional balance, yeah. You know? And that doesn't mean that gives us a pass for, like, bad behavior or something, but it right. does mean that emotionally it makes us much more sensitive
right.
and responsive to things that lead to tears over little things. So, and that's not bad. You know, that's something beautiful in its own way.
So men and women cry. Sometimes it's for the same reasons. That's good. Sometimes it's for different reasons. That's fine as well. But I would say women should definitely curtail tears when they are using it to manipulate, mm-hmm. and they can do that. They're unfairly commandeering the male impulse to protect, mm-hmm. and of like, I see my wife cry and I melt, and I immediately of like, you know, if my wife and I got in some type of a disagreement, we're in a fight, and she's bowing up to me, you know, and I'm okay, we're argument to argument. But if all of a sudden her face twists and she cries and she nestles her head in my I'm done. I'm kind of like, I don't remember.
That's better than yelling at each other, though.
I don't remember what the fight was about, but I know, oh, protector mode. And now, oh, here we go. And, you know, but a man has a natural innate desire to protect and provide, and those tears draw you close to us and draw us close to you as well. But they can be hijacked when a woman of like, say you're dead wrong, mm-hmm. more wrong than him. And somehow in your womanly way, you get him apologizing and you don't apologize at all. And you got mm-hmm. tears and stuff. I'm like, nope, that's emotional warfare. And you can't just cry and manipulate like that. And I think girls will do that. You know, the girls are capable of that. You'll cry to get out of your speeding ticket and it works.
Yeah, it's true. And there's even like, I hear sometimes I've heard, you know, the braggadocio of, oh, by behaving this way, get free stuff, or behaving this way, you know, get out of the speeding ticket or whatever. And yeah, that is its own sort of excess or defect of the feminine, just like there's excesses and the defects of the masculine.
That's it. And it turns out we're all just sinners.
We really are. It's stinks, but
we just have
true.
Very different ways of getting
it's
what
true.
We want.
Yeah, typically know? It's true. All right, so when you start Warrior Poet Society and you launch your YouTube channel and everything else, my understanding is you weren't necessarily talking about abortion yet. I mean, that wasn't really something that was a topic.
No.
What changed for you? I mean, you recently had a video specifically about the last 100 years of abortion. You've done content now on it and challenging men to speak out on it. One of the things we fight at Live Action, as you know, is, you know, this is not just a women's issue, right? So the pro-abortion side is like, this is a women's issue.
Right.
Although actually, what is a woman anymore, right? But that's typically yeah. been a line that they use. And then on the pro-life movement, I think sometimes there's this sense for a lot of good men that, hey, my wife's gonna go volunteer at the pregnancy center and I support her doing that, or you know, whatever, but I'm not necessarily going to take this issue seriously the way she is. My way to support her, you know, I'll just let her do her thing with it, right? It's about babies and women.
Yeah.
And the reality is half of all babies who are killed are boys.
That's right.
Every child that's killed had a mother and a father.
Right.
And this is about human rights and men, especially who are called to protect, we need their voices and advocacy.
Right.
So walk us through what was the kind of aha moment for you, or the moments for you that made you decide, I want to get more involved.
Sure. So to start, we were really majoring more on firearms related content on our social media and our YouTube and everything else like that. And so, hey, what gun to carry, and this is how you shoot, and this is how you use cover and concealment, and this is how to read criminal threat indicator so that you know an attack's coming. And so a lot of stuff like that. Over the years, our channel kind of gravitated into spaces that were natural. Some of them were philosophical. A lot were masculinity. And so that's cooked into the DNA of the beginning. But we didn't kind of start getting political until maybe a couple years ago. And what I noticed is the list was growing of all the things you couldn't say. Politics had begun swallowing everything up. And so everything became a political issue. Like, for instance, live action deals in protecting babies and warring against abortion. And somehow, abortion is considered a political issue. How do you feel about abortion? Oh, I don't really want to talk politics. Well, how is this political? Well, I was dealing with the same thing as I'm not a political animal. I do not like politics at all. And for a long time, I was able to hold that at arm's length. But once politics came, you know, for guns and Second Amendment stuff, now guns became this hyperly charged political issue. And so I started pushing into all these different areas where it's like, no, 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 it's just truth. And wherever we find lies, we seeking what is noble and true as Warrior Poet Society, I'm going to speak out about that. Whatever I'm passionate about, we're not just pro-life. I want to become vocal about it. It happened when we decided that we were going to adopt a child. We'd always wanted to. And then maybe around 2019, we decided, no, and it's time. We believe we're supposed to adopt. And so we went through these painful home studies and getting everything lined up so you could do that. We went ahead and start paying the first amount of the ransom money that we had to all these organizations that do this huge amounts of money, amazing amounts of difficulty and bureaucratic hoops to adopt a baby. Incredible. I want to adopt a baby. And they dug up my septic tank to make sure it all looked good.
Wow.
In my backyard. They made me bring in a construction crew to uncover the septic tank so some social worker could be like, all right, looks good.
I got to pause here for a minute and say something about what you're describing that I think is so important, and then I want you to continue telling the story. But this is very important. Today, IVF, surrogacy, all these things. You can be two men and decide, if you have enough money, I'm going to pay for 10 embryos and implant two and two surrogates. There's no digging up of any septic tanks. There's a lot of money involved, but there's no home study. You know what I'm saying? Like you can, what's so crazy to me is that, you know, we have this high, high threshold to adopt babies that need to be adopted, which to some degree, there's a lot of merit to that, right? To make sure they're gonna go to good homes. But in surrogacy and big fertility, these babies are like products and anybody can buy them if they have enough money.
Right. Well, we experienced a very painful bureaucratic side. It was asinine to me. They're like, we had to have full like blood workups of me, my wife, and our two.
You had blood work done.
Yeah. We had full physicals. Our dog, we had to give dog medical records to make sure we could get it.
So you went through the process and you got the sign off.
And then it was just a matter of waiting for cases to come through. And we did that, and cases were coming through. And we had been told by our adoption agency that typically a family matched within about 3 to 4 months. And so we were expecting, like, all right, 3 to 4 months, we're going to have a baby. We set up a nursery and we decorated it. We had a crib. We were ready. We were thrilled. We had little stuffed animals and didn't know what we would get. So we had...
So you were open, boy or girl?
We really wanted girl in the beginning, but after we had some difficulty, we're kind of like, we'd like a baby with a heartbeat. We would like a living baby. You know, it's just kind of like we're trying to get any baby.
The other thing that's so wild about your story, and I've heard other stories like yours, I have talked to probably, I know, a dozen couples that are desperate to adopt and on waiting lists, and they struggle to have the opportunity to adopt.
Yeah.
And there is this mythology, especially on the pro-abortion side, this lie, this narrative that, oh, people don't want to adopt, pro-lifers are not adopting, there's all these unwanted babies, and so we need abortion.
Right.
Right? And that is a lie. There are an estimated 2 million families waiting to adopt who would take that baby and love that baby and even consider an open adoption to include the birth mom, depending what she wants. But we're killing our babies.
Yes. Over 1 million abortions in the U.S. a year, and over 2 million families waiting to receive those babies. And so, yeah, I remember that long line. Now, here's something that's very upsetting. My wife and I were waiting in that line. Cases were coming through, and we're saying yes, you know, and it's a real quick race. As soon as a case comes through, within a few minutes, so many families have said yes that if you can't within even just a few minutes say yes, then someone else is going to scoop it up. They're not even going to present your booklet, your case before this mom.
And is this an email program?
This is an email.
So you have to be checking your email constantly. Getting the alerts.
For 2 years, we traveled with our phones at the ready so that if a case came through, what we would do is we would open up this PDF and it would say, okay, the mom just get, this would be a stork drop for just for instance, if the mom just gave birth, she was high on methamphetamines and is homeless. History of bipolar personality disorder. Father is either this race or perhaps this other race or could be such and such. And so they'll give this workup and they're like, has hep C and syphilis. And then you'll be like, yes. And seriously, we're
You were just, yes, that was your yes.
And you do it right away.
I don't care. Like, there's obviously suffering in these cases, but we want to love this baby.
So, and we weren't just completely yes to everything, like hardcore fetal alcohol syndrome. That's a special case. It's better if the mom was using crack cocaine than indulgent in alcohol, like getting hammered drunk all the time. The fetal alcohol syndrome is worse than the crack baby recovery.
And you need a special family to deal with those challenges.
And we weren't that special family. And so there were some things we would say no to, but we were saying yes very quickly to cases we never dreamed of. And then if you get it, you know, it's not like $30,000 like it was before. It'd be somewhere up all in $50,000 to $60,000. For me, I'd have to pay $60,000 to adopt a homeless woman's crack baby so that we could bring it in and love that baby
so
forever.
Who gets that money?
Love to know.
Okay.
It was funny.
She's not getting it, right? It's not like the homeless mother gets.
No, she will.
She'll get medical bills paid,
that's right.
I think, but it's not like she's getting a check.
Correct. Now,
the bureaucrats, I guess, the placement.
The adoption agency
is typically. That money goes to pay all the bureaucracy bills, is my understanding, typically.
Right. So the adoption agencies, it's funny, they always charge these big round numbers. $30,000 adoption agency. I'm like, that's a very round number. Show me how you arrived at that. It's always these big round numbers. But then some will go to attorney fees. Mm-hmm. Some will go to, attorney fees is going to be part of it. State's going to get something. You didn't really get this beautiful itemized thing. And here where I'm butchering it a little bit, my wife would be way more tuned in. Now, if it's not more of a sudden stork drop, like a delivery came and it's up for adoption, a lot of gals would know their adoption was coming months out. And so in those cases, they would match with a family way before the birth even happened. And then they'll select you, they'll present on all these different cases, and they'll look at our book and our family and see, and they would get to pick whoever they want as a family. Now, if that mom chooses us, then we will take care of her living expenses and her medical, that'll be the birth itself, prenatal care, aftercare, we'll pay for apartment, and we'll also deal with the fees, the turn, all of it.
But you were willing to do all of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yet it wasn't working.
Anybody in that 2 million person line is signed up for that. That's what they're doing.
Yeah.
So these are not impoverished families. These are folks that have gone through wild amounts of background and due diligences, far more than would be required to just make sure that you're not the Dahmer family ready to carve up a new child. And it's like before the government pretends to actually care what's happening to these babies, I'd love to hear them weigh in on genital mutilation for minors. Mm-hmm. Like, really, these people care what happens to the babies? So anyway, the virtue signaling is not lost on me.
What's also tragic, too, is that, if the adoption isn't completed, there will be, and the mother is struggling with drug addiction, homelessness, mental health challenges that are significant, that child will often end up in a foster care situation, which means that instead of having, one family that is caring for them from birth, they're going to be passed through multiple households. And, there are some amazing foster care parents. I know many who do foster care, and they're beautiful, and they're just so self-sacrificing and loving these kids. But it is very challenging for a little one to go from home to home like that. That is very developmentally it can be very developmentally damaging for a little one to experience that. So, you know, obviously adoption, I'm curious your thoughts on this, John. Adoption is very beautiful. It's very beautiful.
Absolutely.
It has its, it has its bitter along with the sweet though.
Sure.
Because you're dealing with losses at a very early age.
Right.
That do stay with you.
Yeah.
Even with all the things that you also have gained as a child.
And I agree.
Of course, speaking about the loss of that biological connection, which is so important.
Right.
But now you have this beautiful new family. And that's why many when young people, when they come of age or as they get older and they're adoptees, they wonder, where am I from?
Right.
And there's that longing for many, not all, but for many.
Yeah.
When you were going into this process, I know you and your wife were thinking about that too.
Right.
What was your kind of your thought process?
Well, one
knowing that might happen in the future.
One, we became extremely grateful for the moms that chose to not abort. You know, all things being said, they chose to be able to give this child a hope in a future when they knew they wouldn't have one. And they could have taken the easy path out and just killed their child. But instead, taking it to term, delivering it, and placing it was actually a quite heroic and loving thing. Now, our story gets real sad about 3 months into our very first home study, our first year trying to adopt. 3 or 4 months in, COVID breaks out. And what was far worse than COVID breaking out was the fear of COVID. What happened was, as all of our cases were coming through, plenty of cases, we were going to have a baby in 3 to 4 months, it looked like. Case. And then the fear of COVID, within the month, they vanished. It went from a flow to this very, very faint trickle. And instead of getting 4 cases a week, we got 2 that month. What happened? Did people stop, you know, getting in between the sheets together? What happened? Where'd all the babies go? And we realized, it dawned on us, no. The fear of going to the hospital and contracting COVID and going through this process, all these would-be mothers who would adopt out just instead opted to have abortions. I can come to no other conclusion. Why did all the cases suddenly vanish?
You're right, because the abortion rate went up during COVID and they left the abortion clinics open. In states like California, heavily populated, they shut our churches down, they shut our schools down. But what was considered essential?
Right.
Abortion clinics, Planned Parenthoods were left open to kill.
Right. And so you and I can kind of guess at what the numbers of abortions in the US are. And I said 1 million a year.
They did go up during COVID.
We don't know how much the real numbers are. They realize it's bad press to give real numbers. And so I have no idea what the real body count is for the unborn butchery that's happening. But I know during COVID, wild amounts of babies started getting murdered because the fear of COVID. Our reaction to COVID, just looking at abortion alone, seemed to rival what the actual virus was killing. And then there's all the effects. I don't care to get into COVID. All I know is that we wanted to adopt a little baby girl and the fear of COVID killed her.
So then at what point did you pull out of the process?
We stayed in it. We stayed in it for 2 years. And it was so heartbreaking of we had this crib set up in our guest room, ready. And my wife, somewhere along the process, stopped going in that room. It's too painful. And every time you get a case, it's saying you're putting your yes on the table, and you have there's an emotional process that you go through where it says, yes, I don't know this baby, but no matter what, no matter what she looks like, no matter what, you know, what damage has been done to her or his brain, we're gonna love him forever, no matter what. And so you gave yourself to that child, sight unseen, knowing, and it's like, is this it? And then no. And so it's up disappointment. And you try everything you can to steal yourself away from that because you want to love this. And meanwhile, you know what's happening. You know that the little kids are being butchered. That's what's happening. And we wanted to rescue one. And so after 2 years, because after your home study expires after a year, you have to do it all over again. And then you got to put in a whole bunch more money. And so we spent tens of thousands of dollars trying to adopt and came up with no baby.
If someone came to you, you know, tomorrow and they said, I want you to adopt my baby.
Sure.
Would you? Yeah.
Probably.
So you're still in it in that sense, but this is that process, that intensity of that process, it wasn't sustainable.
Mm-mm. No.
It's interesting because I've heard stories similar to yours. Yeah. And also in the foster care space where there are families who want to foster newborns and they're saying, we're open to adopt this newborn.
Yeah.
And the heartache, you know, they're there to parent that newborn as long as their biological parents need them. So they understand this is not our child. We're going to love them like our own, but we're not going to, you know, expect our own out of this experience with this one. But what's so tragic is that often in those cases, you know, there's years they can go through. You know, close friends, we've gone through these cycles. So, but I just want to commend you and Becca because you're living the pro-life ethic. I mean, that is such a beautiful, painful, but beautiful thing to open yourself up to love and loss like that. And, you know, again, millions of couples are doing it. It's beautiful. And what kind of reform do you think our system needs for this to be resolved?
I think, you know, strong men need to join strong women and be able to do something to eliminate this bureaucratic red tape and to be able to promote life through adoption. It's a beautiful alternative, and it's squashed, and you have to go through wild amounts of money and red tape to be able to adopt a baby that is so easy to just kill instead. And it's just evil. It's sick, it's twisted, and it's evil. The system is designed to make it very expensive and very difficult to rescue a baby's life. And that is evil. I have zero political aspirations. I do not want to run for public office. Never do I want that. The Lord would have to descend with an archangel shout to tell me to run for public office. I do not want to do it. I have no plans to do it. However, the only time I entertain the idea is to be able to get in and reform adoption and foster and pro-life. That's, I'd want to pursue that platform because it's got to change.
What's the first thing you would do to change it?
I would lean in to eliminate abortion. You're not allowed to murder your young.
Great answer.
You're not allowed to murder your young. This is the greatest crime against humanity. We have zero right to throw stones at the evil dictators of old. Pol Pot, Mao Zedong, Lenin, Stalin, Mussolini, Hitler. You say of like, look at the droves of people they murdered. Mao Zedong, tens of millions. And we're murdering a million babies a year. What right do we have to castigate the dictators of old as evil? We're doing the same thing. We just don't have concentration camps. We do it in the clean laboratories with a clinical, sterile feel. And the population saying, you're so brave. It's sick. It's twisted. We are sick and twisted. And I believe it will be years of our kids, our grandkids looking back and being able to see clearly that we were just murdering our own kids for years. And all the rhetoric that we assuage our own guilty consciences with, oh, no, we were just pro-choice and we thought that it was the mother's body. And they'll answer of like, no, it was the child's body. Do y'all understand how DNA works? Do y'all understand a mom doesn't temporarily get two brain in another brain and another heartbeat and a unique DNA code and a different blood type? How did you think that that was the mother's body? I'm like, well, you had to have been there. They'll want to lean in and say, Mom, Dad, what did you do to rescue babies during this evil genocide against the unborn? And I want to be able to look at my grandkids and say, I fought tooth and nail. I gave money. I spoke loudly. I was hated for that opinion that I gave, but I fought during that time. And so I think we have a butcherous, murderous genocide against the most fragile, vulnerable people in our society. And protectors don't get to call themselves protectors if you're not pro-life.
Amen. How do we eradicate abortion? What do we do to stop this?
I was going to ask you that.
I have some ideas. We're working on it.
I'm going to take your ideas. Okay. And I'm going to make a warrior poet call. And I'm like, dudes, get online.
Well, step one, I know for the warrior poets, is get the warrior poets treating this as a number one priority.
Yeah.
Because I think we tend to, with all the social stuff going on in our country, cultural stuff, you know, personal stuff, whatever, economic, political stuff, it can get lost in the mess of one other issue.
Yeah.
And there's new flashy issues every single week, it seems.
Yeah.
Foreign wars, I mean, the transing of the kids is obviously horrible, like all this stuff. But the fact is nothing can even compare to that death toll.
Right.
Of almost a million children killed every single year in this country legally by our own medical system. And with the voluntary, you know, often the own voluntary nature of women and men coming together to say, yeah, let's do this.
Yeah. When Roe v. Wade fell recently, I got the news. I was actually scheduled to get on a call with one of your gals because we were trying to do more with y'all. And I saw that headline. I was in my truck. I'd pulled over, and I just wept in joy. I'm like, that there's some progress. That's great. That's fantastic. And we still have so much work to do. But I don't think politically that's ever going to be outlawed until the people demand it. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a lot of sociological work to do. People need to see abortion as abhorrent. They need to see it for what it actually is so that we would recoil from our sin of omission and commission, that we would recoil against being able to just passively stand by while babies were murdered. And be able to say, absolutely not. And I think if enough people did that, the politicians would have to give in or risk being cast out.
I agree. The other thing, the other aspect of this that I know you know is that when it comes to abortion, 9 out of every 10 women who have an abortion, she's a single mother. Yeah. She's not married. Sometimes there's a boyfriend in the picture, but often he's telling her, go get this abortion, here's the money.
Yeah.
And so what precedes the crisis of children being killed all over our country, murdered, butchered, is this crisis of love.
Right.
Breakdown of relationships where we just treat sex as casual today, or this sort of like adult thing that adults get to do at their own pleasure, as long as there's consent and make sure there's consent. And we forget that little fact that sex is designed to make babies.
Right.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
And then we think we're entitled to sex without consequences or responsibility.
Yeah.
And so that's why we have abortion. The number one reason we have abortion is because people don't take responsibility. They don't want to take responsibility. And they've been brainwashed to think that sex is about their adult pleasure and not about family, commitment, love, responsibility, all these beautiful things.
Right.
What do you think is the message to men, especially, about this?
Well, I think there is an abdication that's happening in the mind of a man of like, oh, well, she is pregnant. I'm like, no, you both have made a child and you are responsible for that child. You're the dad now, whether you wanted to be or not. To encourage that abortion is to share the bloody hands with the mom. You are helping determine that. You know, you are now a co-conspirator to that murder. And so you don't get to encourage that and make her do your dirty work for you. You have a responsibility. It's the same old sin of Adam. Eve was seduced, and Adam sat by silently like a coward, and it didn't eliminate his responsibility. His fall was still on his own hands.
NBA player Anthony Edwards recently, it was just a couple months ago, there was a big news story because direct messages came out that he sent to a woman that he, I guess, hooked up with online. I think he was maybe cheating on his girlfriend, and he got her pregnant. And he told her very, very casually, caustically even, you get an abortion, lol. I mean, that was his thing. And then he paid her $100,000 to get an abortion. And she holds responsibility. She went and got it. She killed that baby. But he holds responsibility that he not only slept with a woman he didn't, wasn't married to and didn't love, but then he went and arranged the death of his own child.
Yeah. Paid for it. Yeah.
I mean, when you hear stories like that and you see this in our culture, this is a thing in our culture. It's not just this one NBA player. What's the solution to that?
I don't know. How do you fix an evil heart, you know? I know only one way. It's the way that happened to me. I would have landed on the other side of this issue and a whole host of other issues if I hadn't been saved by Jesus. Mm. There are just two camps, you know. You're with Jesus or you're not. And this man who's willing to give $100,000 of blood money sounds high, but the cost to your soul, that's not worth it.
Any other ideas on what we can do? I know Warrior Poet Society, what you do with your organization is it's men. You're reaching out to men, you're strengthening men. How to get more men to be active and leaders in the pro-life space?
Sure. Well, one is just identify this is not a female's fight. Mm-hmm. Men, are you protectors? Yes or no? Okay, you are protectors. Protectors of, human life. Great. Does it matter how old they are? Does it matter what gender they are? Like, no, we're protectors of human life. Well, why not babies? Why not unborn babies? And sometimes it's like a blind spot. If a lot of our community had, there was an active killer event happening and you're armed, most of our society, warrior poets, are going to be able, at least able, to respond to a threat. And somebody's right in front of you with a gun trying to hurt somebody, our community is ready to defend innocent life and put down the bad guy. The only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And so they're ready to defend life. And they see that as a protector, as a no-brainer protector element. And I'm like, well, how much so? There's no guns here. There's no need to risk your life even. Just say it out loud on social media and say, abortion is murder. That would be the cost here. You don't have to run into a hail of gunfire.
If everyone just acknowledged abortion is murder,
you could help.
We'd make so much progress.
You could potentially save a life, not with a medical kit, a tourniquet, or a gun. You could potentially save life just by speaking out and calling abortion what it is. It's a mom murdering her own child. And if we made that socially repulsive, and that could be accomplished just by enough voices echoing it, and you could be one of those, you could protect life any moment. Quit self-censoring. Quit playing the part of coward, young man. Abortion is murder. Say it out loud. Repeat after me. It's murder. It's killing. It's not, her body, her choice. That is such horse crap. It's an abdication of obvious reality. It's murder. It just is. And you could speak out. You could have a voice for those little babies that don't have voices. Are you a protector or not? We need to get in this fight. I'm in this fight now. Our failed adoption attempts propelled us forward. We had raised money to be able to afford to buy one of these kids out of, you know, this system that just felt like this bureaucratic scam, but we were ready to do it. And when we finally, after a couple agonizing years, folded up our nursery and said, our hearts cannot take this anymore, we took that money and we donated it to Live Action.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to. We slam dunked that offering. I want to be able to help not only speak out and use our platform to save the unborn, I need your organization to win more than it already is. And organizations like it that are on the front lines. I was thinking about this in my hotel room this morning, getting ready to come here. I'm a defender. I've been on different battlefields. I'm a defender of human life. I'm a protector. And I've saved people's lives. But I was thinking as I was getting ready, I haven't saved as many lives as Lila has. And I'm like, way to go. Good job. I went in on that fight. And so we've joined you, and I want other people to as well. I need your organization to win. Live Action is a force for good, and y'all are doing great. We need you to do even better, and everyone needs to help.
Thank you, John. Mm-hmm. Thank you to Becca, too. Mm-hmm. And we're rooting for you guys, and thank you for being a warrior poet who's unabashedly and proudly pro-life, because only the true ones are. Mm.
Good call.
Where can people find your stuff, your work?
Just type in Warrior Poet Society and watch the algorithm hide us and bury us.
You'll find a poetry reading by a drag queen in a public library.
Such a good joke. Okay. That's such a good joke. If you visit warriorpoetsociety.com, that's kind of the launch point, our book, The Warrior Poet Way. I'm so used to working in teams that I'm like, my book, The Warrior Poet Way, you can find on our website. We also have like a streaming service and app so we can sidestep all the censorship big tech has happened. That's a great way to find us and support us. And so all of our store and whatever, warriorpoetsociety.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, John.